Hey everyone, welcome to Entrepreneurship by Design with Dr. C. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline, and thank you so much for joining us today. Entrepreneurship looks different for everyone. How and why we start our business, challenges that occur, pivots we have to make, success we achieve, all while life is happening. That's why I love sharing these inspiring entrepreneurs with you and shed light that there's enough room for everyone to succeed and thrive, even if you're in the same industry. I'm so glad you're here today because today we have such an incredible guest with us, Simon. Simon is a husband and father of two based in Queensland, Sunshine Coast. Simon is also the founder of Mindful Men, a therapy practice that is dedicated to supporting men with mental illness and disability. Simon's passion for mental health comes from living with obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, depression, anxiety, burnout over the past 30 years. Simon shares his story to inspire other men to share theirs. Thank you so much for being here today, Simon. It is such a pleasure to have you. And I would love for you to just dive into your journey, how you got here today, and then we'll go a little bit deeper.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and share my story. It's something I'm really passionate about. And my story, I guess, as a lived experience therapist here in Australia is one that is, I guess, intertwined with 30 plus years living with mental illness myself. So since the age of 8, and I'm about to turn 40 this year. So live with obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, anxiety, and even experienced burnout in 2020 as well. So I know what it's like to be a client of the mental health system, but I also know what it's like to bottle things up for a long period of time. So my diagnoses were actually undiagnosed for 20 plus years. And for those years, I, you know, suffered in silence, like many guys in Australia, but also around the world. I interview a lot of guys around the world. It was kept silent because of the whole masculinity and culture of, you know, suck it up, be a man. Guys, boys and men don't talk about their emotions and their feelings. And so I kind of bought into that as well. And so for 20 years, didn't have the words to talk about mental illness. And I remember, you know, coming towards the end of my high school and going, I don't know what I'm feeling or experiencing. I know it's not quite right. I know it's in my head. And I would love to have a career that involved helping people just like me. I just didn't know how to go about it because in the 80s and 90s and, you know, even the early noughties, like mental health discussions weren't really a thing, particularly where I grew up. And so I didn't know that you could be a counselor or a social worker or a psychologist or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And also noting that none of my family went to university, like I didn't know that that was a pathway for me. I just figured that you do university or you do high school, you do university, you get a job in some sort of office somewhere, and that's, you know, that's pretty much it. And, you know, the Australian dream or the American dream or whatever dream it is, it's very similar around the world. And yeah. And so I went on a bit of a 15-year roundabout tour of my career, and I entered the public service and I became a public servant. And it wasn't until around 2018 that I just started to really realize that it wasn't lighting me up. I wasn't passionate about it. It was just a job after uni. And so I decided to go and study again. And this time I knew what mental health was. I'd been diagnosed by this stage. And so I went to my local university and I said, oh, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to help people just like me. And the careers counselor introduced me to social work. And I'm like, yep, this sounds great. It's creative. It works in mental health. I can do what I want and not be so restrained, you know, like I am in my public service career. And off I went. So I started doing that part-time as a Masters of Social Work. I was still working full-time in my full-time day job. In that period, we had two kids as well, two very young kids. So my kids are 3 and 6 at the moment. And, you know, battling my own mental health condition because it is a bit of a roller coaster. And then COVID hit during this period as well. And we had, you know, like many people around the world, lots of lockdowns. And Australia, I think, had some of the worst lockdowns or the longest lockdowns. And it was funny because in 2020, I experienced burnout, as I mentioned before, and everything kind of just stopped. And I couldn't function either emotionally, spiritually, mentally, physically. I was just like a potato on the couch. And I took about 5 or 6 months off of work. And during that period, I really realized that I definitely needed to get out of that public service career. I needed to do something that, you know, filled my cup up with joy. And it's interesting because during that period, I was first introduced to mindfulness, and the business I run now is called Mindful Men. But at first, mindfulness to me, it didn't sound masculine enough, if that makes sense. Like it sounded very much like practice your three things that you're grateful for each day, and write a gratitude journal, and you know, think more positive affirmations. And I bought into that for a little bit, but it kind of withered away. I didn't really connect with it.
Yeah.
And so I parked it and you know, just continued on my therapy journey and got back to work after 5 or 6 months. But then I finished my degree and I'm like, I fell into a major depressive episode again. And I'm like, I really want to get out and do my own business. I want to start a therapy business. But I just didn't know how to do that because there was a few conflicts of interest with the work that I was doing at the time, with the work that I wanted to do. And the only real way to make it work was to quit my job. And I'd had this public service career for 15 years. How do you just quit your job when it's a stable income? You know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, economic turmoil with COVID, and you can't just get jobs and they pay you $100,000 a year, like what you're expecting in your old job. And so I was in a real, real pickle and I didn't know what to do. And it's interesting how my transition came about, because it was a very consumerist issue that happened to me. My wife and I, we put a deposit down on a brand new car, and I'd always wanted a ute, which is a truck, you know, if you're over in the US, and I'd always wanted this type of ute. It was a Toyota Hilux and it had SA. The badge was SR, which is my initial, Simon Rooney. And I don't know why, it's a really silly reason to want this particular kind of ute, but it had SR on the back and I loved it. And it would be my own branded car. But because of COVID, it was going to take 9 to 18 months to get made and then get transported to Australia and then me actually access the car. So I had all this money sitting around and I was getting really annoyed because I wanted this ute. My old car had pretty much was on its last legs. And I said to my wife, why don't we forget the brand new ute and just get a secondhand one? And we found one, you know, down the road about an hour down south and start the business. Now, my wife is very risk adverse, and usually she would just say, Simon, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But for some reason, she said yes. And she said, I can see you just miserable. We've got the money there. Yeah, we don't need a new car. It'd be nice to have a new car, but let's just go for it. And it was a really weird feeling to all of a sudden this like weight lifted off my shoulders of this depressive episode that I was going through.
Yeah.
And I remember calling up my work because I was on leave at the time as well. I was on about 3 months leave for mental health. And I called up my boss and I said, I'm not coming back. And it was a huge thing to say, because I'd only ever known that career, and then to step out and into, you know, okay, now I've got to start a business. I've never been in business before. I don't know how to do that. I don't know all the things. Like all of a sudden I've got to find clients and figure out how to market myself and all the things that come with a small business. Mm-hmm. And it was just lucky that I had this bucket of money. So I had, you know, this bucket of money that was meant to go to the new car that was now sitting in the bank, and we could use that to pay the mortgage. So I had a bit of a buffer there, which was really awesome. And then off I went. So August last year, I pulled the pin on my old career and jumped into Mindful Men as a business. And then since then, it's been a roller coaster ride of emotions and a lot of hard work, a lot more hard work than I thought it would be. But yeah, here I am now. It's we're getting close to a year. I think it's like 9 months or so now. And yeah, it's doing really well. And so I call it Mindful Men because I've found a way for mindfulness to work for me. It didn't initially work, as I mentioned, but I did find a way that it works for me. And I specialize in men because of my own journey. So, you know, those 20 years in silence and drowning my sorrows with alcohol and trying to figure out in my brain, you know, what it was to live with mental illness just didn't serve me. And so, you know, I do what I do because I want to inspire other guys to go, you know what, Simon's talking about his mental health and you know, he's doing this thing called Mindful Men. Maybe it's okay for me to talk as well. And that really lights me up. And, you know, I jump out of bed now every morning and do things like this at 6 o'clock in the morning and doing this late at night and seeing clients on the road. And it's just an amazing feeling to be in my own business. Mm-hmm. But also to do it from a place where I have spent a lot of, you know, decades in pain. But now I kind of look at it as my superhero power. And it's something that I really draw from, because I know when a guy walks into my clinic, or I walk into his house, or we meet at a cafe, or wherever we go to do therapy, that I know kind of the some of the steps that they've been through. And each person's step is, you know, journey is unique to them. I don't know everything about their journey, but I know what it feels like to not feel okay. And so, yeah, that's where I'm at the moment. It's probably a little bit of a roundabout, twisted and turned along the way, but yeah, that's mental illness. And I don't hide away from that. I like to show it in all of its glory. So yeah, thanks for having me on to share this journey with you.
I so appreciate you sharing all of that too, because, you know, you've gone through so much, and just the capacities of what you mentioned with OCD, depression, anxiety, and burnout, and really has shaped a lot of your advocacy for mental health from your own journey, but going into the field as well to learn the clinical side of it. And can you share some specific moments or experiences that led you to Mindful Men and dedicate your work to this?
Yeah, so I'd always wanted to have my own business. That was an underlying thing. And I knew it kind of needed to be a therapy business as well. But what really defined how I did that was that burnout story. So I knew that during burnout that I no longer wanted to work for other people, and it really solidified it that I wanted to do my own thing. And because I'd been a client of the mental health system for the last decade, so from 2012 is when I got my diagnosis, and since then I've been to every type of therapist you can think of. Like, I really understood what it was like to sit in a therapy room and sit on the couch. And I really enjoy it now. Like, I actually like to go, to find a place of healing. But I know for probably half of that last decade, I didn't really enjoy it. Like, it was boring. I walked in, like many guys and people and girls as well, you know, women as well, like expecting or hoping that they would just wave a magic wand and I'd be healed and all that type of stuff. So I kind of wanted to look at therapy and figure out how can we do it differently.
Yeah.
And so through my own social work degree, I did a placement in a private practice as well. And I really got the understanding of what it's like to be a therapist. And I didn't want to do six sessions a day in a clinic. I get a little bit, not claustrophobic, but I just like to get out and about and move around, and sitting in one room all day just didn't light me up as well. And I probably, that was a good thing to experience as a student, because I realized I don't want to be working A, for somebody else, and B, I don't want to do six sessions a day in a clinic. And so during that process, I kind of designed or redesigned what therapy looks like and feels like for me. And so I do a lot of mobile therapy. And I came to that just through giving it a go when I started my business. I knew what I didn't want. So I said, okay, well, what do I do want? And so I started connecting with a few of the clients that were referring in. I said, hey, I've got a clinic, but do you want to try something different? And a lot of the guys actually said, yeah. I said, okay, we've got amazing beaches here, so let's go down the beach and do the therapy at the beach. And you know, a lot of them say, yeah, let's go do that. And we either walk along the beach. I had one client who wanted to get in the water one time. So I often wear, it does, my wife often laughs at me because I wear just t-shirt and shorts. Like, it looks like I'm going for a run pretty much every single day. But I do that because it could be at the beach one minute. The next client could be playing basketball. The next one could be in his room playing video games. The next one could be in the clinic, or the next one's on telehealth. So my day is very diverse. And I just kind of came about it by going, what do guys like? You know, they don't like necessarily sitting in a room and on a clinic couch and divulging everything. They might do that the first time, but after that, they just want to get out and move and walk around. And so I really just honed in on that experience from my own. But also, going back to my burnout story, is part of my recovery was discovering mindfulness, but in a way that incorporated movement. And so what I would often do is I'd walk around my local park just down the road here, and I would hone in on using my five senses on nature. And so I'd really go, you know, I'd brush my hands across trees as I walk past them, or I'd really take note of what the clouds are doing or what the wind's doing. Or if I stopped for a coffee at the cafe, you know, I'd really tune into my sense of taste and smell and just really focus on that, because I found it really helped with my recovery from burnout and to decrease my stress. And so part of the reason I wanted to explore, you know, therapy outside as well, was to incorporate that with the guys that I work with as well, and say, hey, mindfulness doesn't have to be this thing that seems emasculine. It can be something that can be quite empowering and strength-based as well. And you can do it on the move without anyone ever noticing it as well. You don't have to sit there and write gratitude journals and think of your big three things, because that only works for some people. But they really buy into this stuff on the move. And yeah, it's from those moments, either through my study or through my own recovery therapy, that I've kind of tweaked the way that therapy's done. And I just call it therapy done differently. So yeah, that's kind of like some of those pivotal moments that led me to do what I do and how I do it as well.
I love that you just redefined so many things that might've kept people, this is all I'm going to do. It's going to be in a clinic or a private practice. And coming from that world too, I felt a little trapped, like what you were saying, of just, I didn't want to be in a room all day, and I would see 12 clients on a daily basis. And it was just exhausting because I'm like, I like to be out in nature and all these other things. But I love that you redefined it of what works for you and being able to pull to those strengths for men in particular, being able to go to the beach or play basketball or video games and like diversify it, so it doesn't feel stuffy. And I love also what you said too about the gratitude list, because I mean, I'm guilty of this. And some of my clients would push back and like, really, Caroline? But I think too, there's a point to that movement or the senses, because like everybody needs something different. That's a great start, but that's not the end all be all. There's so many different resources. And I mean, now with social media, how much it's really exploded of more therapists being on social media, because when I left the field, there wasn't as many of us on it. And that was a few years back, dating myself a little bit. But I'm curious, because men's mental health is so stigmatized or overlooked sometimes. And what motivated you to break that silence, encourage men to share their stories and create that space that's so safe and supportive?
Yeah, I think it stems back to, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s in an environment that was, well, A, mental health discussions weren't a thing back then, and not even into the noughties from my perspective as well. Mm-hmm. And I remember growing up, and if I cried for whatever reason, I'd be quickly told to suck it up, you know, harden up. I played a lot of sport as well, so you'd see that on the sports field, you see it at school. And I bottled everything up. I didn't know how to talk about things. And I think having lived with OCD since I was eight, and it being undiagnosed, and it caused a lot of pain in my life. And I remember in my teens, you know, getting suicidal ideation and not knowing how to process that, because I didn't have a way to talk about it. I didn't have a positive male role model to talk to about that. Like, I've got a dad, but dad doesn't talk about his emotions. It's one of those old school things, like, yeah, guys don't talk about this stuff. And it was even like, it was even in the media as well. I remember watching things like The Terminator, Die Hard, Rambo. These are the movies that I grew up with. You know, I watched wrestling on TV. Back then it was a little bit more physical than it is perhaps now. And all these things, these are the things I consumed. And so, okay, I see people on the TV, they're bleeding, or that, you know, Bruce Willis has been shot and he keeps walking through and saves the day, or you know, and, you know, my footy players, they'd get smacked in the head and they'd be bleeding, but there was no blood rules back then. So they would keep playing on the field. Whereas these days, if you get cut on the field, you're taken off and so forth. And this is just the environment I grew up in.
Yeah.
And so I learned to bottle it up and didn't know how to process it. But I think it came about, something really, you know, stands out for me is in my public service career, and this is around 2015 or so, I want to say. And I, for the first time, I heard this concept around doona days. So this idea of having a mental health day, because you just can't face the world. You need to just stay in bed, sit on the couch, you need to just disconnect. And I'd never heard of this term before. And I heard someone in the office say it, and I'm like, oh, that sounds like a really good idea. And nobody knew I had this mental health stuff except for my wife and my GP and my therapists. And I tried it one day. I rang up my boss and I was really struggling. And I rang my boss and I said, I just don't think I can come in today. I need a day off for my mental health. And that's the first time I really overtly said anything about my mental health. And my boss was like, you know what, Simon, thanks so much for being honest. Most people don't say, they're not as honest about that as you would just were. So thank you so much. Have the day. Come back tomorrow. We'll see you tomorrow. Anyway, so I did that, and there was nothing that came about it until a week later. And I'm in the office, and we're having a big team meeting. We had about 15 or so people in our team, and my boss didn't explicitly say, "Look at me," when she said this. She said basically to the team, she said, "Oh, we had a few absences lately, and also like just remember that having a mental health day or a doona days aren't a valid reason to have a day off." And I sank in my chair, and she didn't look at me. She didn't say my name or anything like that, but I knew exactly who she was talking about. And I'm like, that sucks. Like that is just not right. And so again, I bottled things up, and a few people said to me, "Simon, do you experience mental health issues?" And to one or two people, I opened up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really relieving until my burnout story. And I come back to my burnout because a lot happened during this period.
Yeah.
But when I recovered from work from burnout and I went back to work, I kind of wanted to share that story with my workplace. It's a different workplace as well, by the way. And I developed this very public service thing. I developed a PowerPoint presentation and had the team come, actually had a few teams come, and I wanted to share burnout because burnout was a real issue in the last place that I worked. Mm-hmm. And so I shared this story about what burnout is, what it looks like, what it feels like, so that people felt like that they were empowered with some knowledge around burnout. And then at the end of that, I tacked on and say, "Oh, this also comes from a place of lived experience of mental illness." And this is the first time I really opened up and said, "I have mental health conditions," to the world. Now, that the public service is still it's probably 75% female, 25% male, but so many people, kids, even the guys would come up to me afterwards and say, "Simon, I didn't know you were going through this."
Yeah.
"And for so long, thanks so much for sharing." Or someone would come up to me and say, "Simon, my partner's been going through the same. And I just got a lot of energy for this." And this is where I guess Mindful Men as an Instagram page started, because the Instagram stuff started way before the business started. And I just wanted to share this story with the world. So it evolved from there, going, okay, people are coming forward and saying, "Simon, we need to talk about this. This is great that guys are talking about this." And so, probably like you, I started a podcast and a YouTube channel myself called the Mindful Men Podcast. And now, it's all over Facebook, TikTok, LinkedIn, all the places I can spread my word and just say, "Look, this is my story." But also I interview so many guests around the world, and just to hear their stories as well. And it's interesting, like no matter how far we are distanced across the world, a lot of our stories are very similar in terms of that suck it up mentality for guys, particularly. It's around, I think the 2020s is around breaking that mold and guys starting to go, okay, you know what? It's not weak if I speak. I mean, it's actually a strength of mine. It's not a weakness. And so I get a lot of fuel from that as well. The early days when I did it was the opposite. It was around, shut up, don't talk about things, just move on with your life and stop being such a wuss or a girl, or stop being so gay. And these are the things that guys are thrown at when they just want to talk about their emotions. These aren't things that are, they shouldn't be sexualized or gender based or anything like that. It should just be a discussion around, hey, I'm not doing so well.
Right. Because at the end of the day, we're human. And I so appreciate you sharing that, because as Brené Brown says, vulnerability is a strength. And, you've been living with OCD, depression, anxiety, and burnout for 3 decades. And undoubtedly, it's been a challenging journey. What you've mentioned, how have you personally managed and coped with these different diagnoses and different things that you've had to encounter? But are there any tools or practices that you've particularly impactfully used in your own journey of healing?
I'll start with the things that I did that weren't so great. And first of all, was bottling up and not talking about it. And for 20 years, that was life.
Yeah.
In my teens, I developed, a strong, liking to alcohol. And I used alcohol for a long time. I still drink today, but not as much as I used to, in terms of a way of numbing the pain and slowing down my thoughts. So anyone who lives with particularly obsessive compulsive disorder or anxiety conditions, your brain races like you wouldn't believe, like a million miles an hour. And you'll have, I always think of people say, if they have their brain inside their mind and it looked like a Google or Safari web page, it would be like 1,000 browsers open up at once. And that's what it's like. It's just, you can't shut it up. And so for a long time, alcohol was the thing.
Yeah.
But I think it was 2012 when my now wife, she encouraged me to go and talk for the first time. And this was a really empowering moment to walk into a doctor's office and say, I think I've got a mental health issue. And then to get a subsequent diagnosis from a psychologist. So that's where the diagnosis of OCD, depression, anxiety came. And, you know, I knew depression, I knew anxiety. I didn't know what OCD was. And then, but all of a sudden having this label, and a lot of people feel stigma around labels, but I feel like it's like, oh, this is what it is. Now I know. So now I can, I'm a big proponent of knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. So by knowing what the diagnosis is, I can go, okay, what we can now deal with this in some sort of way.
Right.
Interestingly enough, I didn't deal with the OCD. And I think that's an issue in terms of the mental health system in Australia, particularly is that there's not a lot of practitioners that deal with OCD. They deal with the anxiety, the depression, PTSD, other psychosocial conditions. Mm-hmm. OCD, there's few and far between therapists that do that kind of work. And so whenever I would go to a therapist, they would focus on the depression primarily. And I'm guessing those symptoms were coming through, but the underlying aspect of that was the OCD, because when I was stressed, depressed, anxious, the OCD was through the roof. Right. And so it wasn't until I started that Instagram account that I discovered a world of people living with OCD, and I felt less alone. I'm like, oh, and then I was introduced to, through social media of all things, exposure response prevention, which is supposedly the gold standard for OCD treatment. And so I've trialed that in the recent years, but I think it all started with opening up and talking about things and doing the cognitive behavioral therapy or doing the acceptance and commitment therapy and just talk therapy, narrative therapy. But ERP was fantastic for the OCD. So now I've got some tools that are specific for OCD that I use. I'm still not great at them, but better than I was 10 years ago and 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But through that, I found mindfulness. And I love talking about mindfulness because at first, as I mentioned before, it didn't work for me. But I found through my social work studies and now as a therapist that there's a lot of cool grounding techniques. And it's really cool for managing things like anxiety and stress, because I live in a constant state of stress and anxiety. I think that's just the way my brain is naturally processed. But and it touches on that mindfulness on the move stuff that I did before, I talked about before. So it's about getting out and grounding myself in nature, or working with clients doing the same from a therapist perspective. It's around getting our feet in the sand or our feet in the water as the water comes up, or it's about sitting at a cafe and you know, in a nice quiet spot and just reflecting on the coffee or the cake that we're eating and actually just mindfully tuning into that. And it's been really cool because when I was talking to one of my clients recently where he was faced with a difficult situation and he tuned into that. Like he actually just went straight into that. He's never done mindfulness before. And after a couple of sessions, he started tuning into, I think he was in a cafe or something and something happened and he started touching stuff and really honing into the feel of whatever he was touching. And it helped him just navigate that situation. And another client, he always talks about the wind. You know, one of the first things I introduced him to in mindfulness was like, oh, it's really breezy today. Like, what's the wind feel like on your skin? Mm. And so since, you know, for the last 4 months, every time I see him, we often talk about the wind. And it's just a cool thing to do. Like, it's just like, and it just grounds so many of the guys. And I didn't think it would have such an impact on the guys, but just these grounding techniques, being out in nature. And that's why I love getting out of the clinic, but we can do it in a clinic. So this is my home office and you can do it over Zoom or you can do it, you know, in a clinic, but it's just not as powerful as out in nature. So that's why I love getting out there. And then the other tip that I come to is around, it comes back to gratitude journaling, but it's a little bit different to what I first experienced. So it's not saying, oh, you know, what are the three things you're grateful for each day? Because anyone who's done gratitude journaling will know that you'll start to regurgitate the same three things pretty much every single day. Like my health, my family, my house, my job. They're usually the four main go-tos. But I was introduced to this different way of breaking down your day into hourly chunks and saying, okay, what did you do between 6 to 7 and 7 to 8 and 8 to 9 and so forth throughout your whole day? Mm. And just writing the everyday things you do. So it could be taking the kids to school. It could be going to see the dentist or going to a cafe and having a coffee or watching your favorite TV show at lunchtime or, you know, while you had your lunch, or even if you're at work, It could have been, oh, I finished a report today, or I sent the email that I've been sitting on for a week. And so all of a sudden you've got this full day of all the everyday things that you would do on autopilot. You don't think about these things. But then what I've been introduced to is going, okay, what are the three things that really gave me some sort of joy today? And it could be getting the kids to school on time for the first time this week. Or it could be having that cup of coffee, because I'm a bit of a coffee snob. So having this cup of coffee that just tasted perfect and it always smelled perfect. Or today I got to go to the gym for the first time in 6 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and these are the things that actually light you up, and they're the things that fill your cup up, because you often don't think about these things. You just kind of, you have that cup of coffee and you don't think about it. You're worried about what's next and what's next and what's next. Mm-hmm. But if we can ground ourselves in that moment, and I always say to my guys, be where your feet are, because you know your feet can only be in the present. Yeah. You start to tune into these things a little bit easier. And then eventually you don't need the journal anymore. You can just do this on the go. You can walk around the block and go, oh, I really love that flower that I saw today. It's the first flower of spring. Mm-hmm. You know, or I just loved how that wind felt on my arms because it's a really hot day today. And it just gave me a nice, refreshing, you know, break from the 40 degree heat that's happening today, or whatever it is, just the everyday things. And it's so, these are powerful tools that I teach the guys, but I also use in my own personal journey as well.
I love that. And, you know, it's also being so present in the moment. And that's what I love about grounding techniques and exercises, because you're able to really focus in on how your toes feel in the sand, or how the breeze hits your skin, or just how that amazing cup of coffee. I'm a huge coffee person, but just how it tastes or whatever it may be. But when you're in that moment, you're not worrying about what's next. All those feelings and emotions come through. Instead, you're just in that present moment. And with the work that you've done with Mindful Men, what are some of the common challenges or issues that you help men navigate?
Getting them into therapy is one really big one. It's interesting. When I opened up when I say open up the doors, it was a virtual thing at the start. And everyone said, oh, men's mental health is so important. It's so needed. This is such a great thing. But then the phone didn't ring. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, and the emails didn't come. And I'm like, where are all these people that everyone thinks this is so important for? I know it's important, but where are all the people? And so that's the hardest thing. It's getting out into places where guys can see me, or their partners, or somebody that they know can see me and go, oh, this service exists to start with. But for guys, and I do a lot in acceptance and commitment therapy. So that's a mindfulness-based therapy. Mm-hmm. And we do a lot of work on values, actually. So we pull out, I've got some values cards, and we go through them and identify what their values are, because 99 out of 100 people haven't done that kind of work before. And so really honing into what are our 4 to 6 key values or core values that light us up, that fill us with joy. So like, is it love, friendliness, trust, honesty, all these types of, you know, words. And then if we can start living by those every day, then we can start to have a bit more purpose and meaning in our lives as well. And so we do a bit of that as well. We do a lot of mindfulness on the move, just to have that, you know, easy walking and or exercise, or depends if you're on the basketball court, it can get a little bit, you know, furious as well.
But sure.
we do all these types of things. And then, you know, I work with a few dads. So I'm a dad as well. So I love talking about parenting and the impacts of parenting, particularly for fatherhoods and fathers and dads. And we often come last after the dog or the cat. You know, it's mom, it's kids, it's animals, then it's, oh, what's dad doing? Oh yeah, he's still, you know, losing his marbles over there. Like, and so giving dads a space to go, you know what, parenting is hard. Like, it's difficult. I'm tired, I'm stressed, I've got to, you know, if I'm the one that's going to work, or if I'm a stay-at-home dad, there's a lot of dads that experience things like loneliness and shame. I remember I spent a bit of time trying to do the stay-at-home dad, and I'd take my kids to the shops to get things, and people would look at you like, oh, what's he doing? Like, shouldn't he be at work? Where's the mom? And like, oh, or you're babysitting your kids today. Like, these are the things some dads go through. And this is a weird one, like taking your, I've heard so many stories of dads taking their young kids to public toilets. Like, you know, you've got the parenting rooms at shopping centers and being told to get out because it's not a space for dads. And like, and so helping dads navigate through this type of stuff as well is really important for me as a dad with two as well. We talk a little about things like alcohol and drug use and how it's associated with mental illness. I also do a lot of work in the disability space as well. So helping guys, you know, with complex disabilities, it could be psychosocial, it could be physical, intellectual as well. Just to come out of their shells and see their strengths and their purpose and things like that. So it is varied, but if I was to pick three things, it would be values, certainly, this sense of identity, trying to break free from that stigma and shame around talking around things, and yeah, a lot of parenting and substance abuse as well. So they're the kind of the hot topics that I deal with at the moment.
Yeah, no, and I think they're very hot topics because it's something that's not fully addressed. And, you know, there's this concept of just being very masculine and bottling up your emotions or not talking about it that's associated with suppressing your emotions. And how do you challenge these societal expectations and encourage men to embrace vulnerability and seek help for their mental health? What you're mentioning, the doors weren't, they were open, but people weren't flying in.
I lead by example a lot. So I talk about my journey a lot and I do it with purpose. It's on shows like this and my own podcast and my own social media, because I just want guys to see it first. And I often say to this, if for a new referral, if they're unsure about coming to therapy, because I get a lot of partners who ring me and say, Simon, can you work with my husband or my boyfriend or my son or whoever? But they're really trying to push them into therapy because they're worried about them. But the guy themselves doesn't really want therapy, or they just don't know it yet. Like, they're still stuck in that mindset. So I lead by example. I show my vulnerabilities. Brené Brown's been great for that. And I just wear it on my sleeve and hope that guys see that as well. Mm-hmm. But when we're in sessions, we talk of things around why they're bottling things up or why they're using alcohol or drugs particularly, and a lot of it comes back to maybe, you know, histories of abuse, trauma, and then that's coupled with I didn't know how to talk about it, I wished I did talk about it back then. So just showing them the tools and sometimes I share some of my insight, my lived experience, but with purpose. It's not about me in sessions, but it's just like, hey, I can get you struggling here, this is how I've also done it as well. I had a really great breakthrough moment with a young fella. He's in his teens, and I don't usually do a lot of work with teens, more adults, but I've got a few teenage clients, and he really struggles with anxiety and like to an extreme, you know, extent as well. And I shared with him recently, like, you know what, I get scared too. And we talked about, and he looked at me and he's like, you're a grown man, like, why, what have you got to be scared about? And so I'd go into OCD and I say, look, this is what obsessive compulsive disorder did to me from 8, which is younger than what you are now, to almost 40. And, you know, and just talking about that, and that opened his eyes up, because he's like, you know, oh, this dude that's I'm sitting in the car with driving around doing mindfulness on the move, like, he doesn't like to go to clinics, so we're a drive around, he loves to go for drives. And just sharing my story in a non-judgmental, non-intimidating way. It's just almost like it's just like normal talk. And it's weird because mental health things aren't things that you would normally just sit there and have a chat about, but I make it very sociable and just talk about it as if it's completely normal, which it is completely normal, which I think also helps to destigmatize the whole process as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge part of it, being able to normalize things and have those conversations, especially with teens in particular, because it's such a weird age. Like, I used to work with a lot of teens, and they're not an adult, like, they're not a kid anymore, but they're not an adult and they're figuring out their way. But I think when they can hear a story that resonates, when it serves that purpose to open up their eyes of, okay, everybody can struggle in different ways, and it's not a one size fits all of like what works best for them either. But I love that you've really led by example and just what you're putting out there and your experiences, because again, it normalizes it and doesn't make it this stigmatized thing that it's been for so long. And it's starting to slowly get less stigmatized, but got a long way to go. But I love the work you're doing, and being a husband and a father, how do you balance your responsibilities with running a therapy practice, but also advocating for men's mental health?
My wife often says I work too much, and I didn't know how hard it was to have a business and how much effort you've got to do, particularly when you're the only person in your business. I have to do everything. So if I'm not on my emails and responding to things, or if I'm not doing my marketing, or if I'm not networking, or if I'm not actually rocking up to therapy, like the bills don't get paid. And so I've quickly discovered that managing my time and energy is really important. And, you know, there's been a few times where I've overextended and I've almost burnt out again in therapy, you know, as a therapist. And so stepping back and going, okay, you know what, I need to maximize my time here. And also, you know, down tools, often my kids would run into, this is my home office, and my kids would run in and they say, daddy, you finish it, daddy, you finish it. I'm like, no, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And probably realizing what's important to do and what's not important to do. I think less admin, I don't need to do all my admin every single day. Mm-hmm. I can let it slide to the next day or the next day and cherish the family time. I think that's really important, particularly when you work from home as well. So I work from home a lot. I am on the road a lot, but you know, when the kids are home, because they're so young as well, they're not, mm-hmm. they are quite reliant on us still as parents. And so recognizing that for starters and actually blocking out time to actually have, you know, family time is hugely important, but also for me time as well, like actually blocking out time to go and do things like my self-care, like go to the gym, go for walks, go down to the beach, do whatever I can for me, because that's really important as a therapist as well, to manage our own self-care, because we talk about it a lot with clients, but it's often we're the ones who aren't doing it because we're so busy doing all the things. And so just realizing that to start with, I guess that's the acceptance from acceptance and commitment therapy, is recognizing it, and then, you know, yeah, just blocking out time and doing it consistently as well. Because I'm one of those all in kind of guys, and then mm-hmm. to a point where I'm almost about to burn out, and I'm like, oh, I've got to pull back. But mm-hmm. I'm trying to find ways to do it more regularly, so it's not such a impost as well. So it's a work in progress. I won't say anyone's listen to that and go, oh yeah, the Simon's got it figured out, because I don't have it figured out.
A work in progress. And I love that you mentioned too about the burnout, because I know that's been a huge part of your story and your journey. Mm. And that was actually a huge part of mine as well, but a lot of people listening too. And I think it doesn't always go away. It's just we manage it or catch it faster. Mm. I don't know if you've had that same experience, but being able to recognize, okay, I need to take a break, or I need to block time out. I need to be there for the kids. I need to be able to be there for my clients. But you know, you said something important as like a former therapist, but when you are working with clients, you're always preaching and talking about like self-care and taking care of yourself. And sometimes from my experience talking to other therapists as well, like we're the worst at it sometimes. Yes. Is that your experience? How have you really navigated your burnout experience of where you are today?
One of the things I said to my therapist at the time was, what happens if this all happens again? Because I can't take 5 months off of work. Well, it did happen again. I took 3 months off of work again, but that was probably a depressive burnout as well. And so since I've been in business, I'm very mindful of burnout happening, because I don't have sick leave anymore. Like as a sole trader, like I don't have, you know, 15 years of leave, but, you know, banked up that I could draw from, which is lucky that I did have in my previous career. Mm-hmm. And so it's just about being mindful of what's happening. And I use external supervision as well. So as a social worker, I have an external supervisor, which is really useful to go and talk about things. And I picked a supervisor that is in private practice as well. Mm. And is, you know, kind of works on her own for a particular reason, because I wanted someone to understand what it was like to not just be a social worker, but be in a small business as well. And so we talk often about business in my supervision as well as the client stuff and therapies. And just getting that different perspective and realizing that things will be okay is really useful, because when you're on your own and business can be a very lonely place when you're mm-hmm. a sole trader and you don't have anyone to bounce, you know, you don't have teams of people to bounce things off. You just have to trial and error it yourself and hope that you're doing okay. And I guess you are doing okay if the money's coming in, because people will pay you. But at the same time, like you often question yourself, you have that imposter syndrome, you know, seeps in. And so it's using things like supervision is really useful, or a business coach. I've had a few business coaches over the last few months as well, trying to accelerate the business, but also help me understand business as well has really been really useful. Understand what why is it important to go to networking events, for example? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I get socially awkward, social anxiety. And so I avoid those types of things. But what I've realized is that, you know, the traditional things that I thought would work, like emails and Facebook ads, Google ads, it goes to a certain, like it's 1%, but like 98% of your referrals come from actually meeting people who are likely to send you referrals. And so reprioritizing that type of stuff. But I wouldn't have known that if I didn't have a business coach or a business mentor or even my supervisor as well. So just tuning into people around me that have more of an idea about business than I do has been really important. And that's helped navigate things like burnout and stress, because I'm not having to overthink everything and recreate the wheel, because the wheel's already been created. I've just got to find out who's rolling it. So yeah, that's essentially how I do it. And then also, yeah, just tuning into my own mental health. So I'm really, having been on my mental health recovery process for 11 years now, I'm really know when I'm struggling and if I need to go and see a therapist. Like I'm back at a therapist right now for the first time in 6 months or so. I just go and get a referral and I go do it, because it's so important for me to start talking about that type of stuff outside of the family home, because my wife, my poor wife, she's bore the brunt of it for a very long time. But it's time that she's no longer my therapist, that I actually just divulge this to trained therapists as well.
Yeah, no, and I love that you said too, it's like that support, because one person can't be everything to us, but knowing we can find the outside support, whether it's a business coach, a mentor, a supervisor, your own therapist, whatever is really going to help you in those moments. And I love that you really identified that too. And the longer you've been in recovery, the last 11 years, as you mentioned, the more it's transparent too. And the awareness is there of, okay, I'm struggling a little bit. I need to get a tune up almost. You go to the gym and get that mental fitness, but you need the physical fitness, but you need the mental fitness too, in order to, you know, just get that extra most important aspects. And so even building your therapy practice and the advocacy platform that you have requires a lot of determination and resilience. What obstacles or setbacks have you encountered along the way that you've had to overcome? And what advice would you give entrepreneurs that are aspiring to be entrepreneurs?
Yeah, absolutely. So living with obsessive compulsive disorder, perfectionism has been huge personality trait of mine for a long time. And everything would have to be perfect. A lot of people misunderstand OCD in terms of when I say perfect, they think, oh, you just got a really neat house or you like things in order. It is a lot more complicated than that. And I see the way that I present myself and do things as almost like my signature. So if people see that, for example, my website, building my own website, I built my own, you know, using WordPress. Most people say, why didn't you use something like Wix or something a bit easier? I'm like, well, YouTube told me to do WordPress, so that's what I did. And I learned from YouTube, and but it almost nearly stopped the business. It took me 3 months. I kept getting into these, finding errors, and it wasn't perfect. And it was really playing my mind, because I felt like as a therapist, I needed a website. And I needed to do this from day one, because that's how people find me. Because when I find a therapist, I look for a website. I don't look for a Facebook page or anything like that. I'm looking for their website. Right. And that really played on me. And so what I found through my social work degree and my practice is all social workers have a framework, practice framework. And I was introduced a few years ago to this concept called wabi-sabi, which is a Japanese concept around the beauty and imperfection. And so what I've been doing over the last few years is consciously trying to be not perfect and reduce that perfectionism, because perfectionism was a key driver towards my burnout as well. It was a key thing that I could no longer hit the bar of perfectionism that I set for myself. Nobody else set it for me. I set it for myself. And so for the last few years, I've been trying to break that cycle. My psychologist had recently said to me, Simon, you've got to learn how to fail. And not necessarily fail spectacularly, but just learn little things that if you fail or if things aren't perfect, that your world will not come crashing down. And so I managed to finish the website. A few little things there that I'm not entirely happy about, but I did it and I put it up. And then it was just around trying. I think perfectionism keeps coming back. It's like just not doing things perfect, just giving things a go. Not overthinking it. I'm probably overthinking a couple of things at the moment. Like I'm trying to do some group program work that I'm developing. But also the things where I've just done it and gave it a go have actually come out really rewarding as well. And so I think that's been a key thing of of trying to battle perfectionism and build a business at the same time. Another one is just, yeah, as I talked about before, is around the importance of networking and not undermining the importance of networking in the particular areas that you're working in. So for example, I work in disability and I do, you know, therapy in the disability space, but to get those referrals, I need to be networking with other people in the disability sector, which I never did. I just thought, oh, I'd send an email and they would get my open now email and they'll go, oh, cool, Simon, let's give you a call. It doesn't work like that. You've really got to go out and network and show your face. And people like to see a face to the company and hear your story and share your story and share why you're doing, why it's so impactful. And then the referrals start to come and just know that it takes time. I think that it does take time. It takes a lot longer than you think to build those networks because they've got to trust you to spend money with you or to refer someone to you. And then also just as a therapist is, and I'm constantly battling with this and I'm constantly talking to my social work supervisor with this, is just know that you're doing a good job. Like I'm often sitting in therapy and going, and in my mind, I'm like, what am I doing wrong? Like, this person not opening up as much today, or mm-hmm. you know, I feel like I don't have enough tools in my toolkit to help to provide them and cure them and all that type of stuff. And often it's just like my supervisor would say, Simon, you're providing them with a safe space to be for an hour.
Yeah.
And just go with that and realize that you don't have to provide them a tool or a tip or a technique or anything. Sometimes it's just nice just to sit in a room with someone and they can just share, or we could just have a chat. A lot of my therapy sessions might not even be a chat about anything mental health or disability related. It could just be two guys chatting. And it seems really weird, but at the same time, it's just giving them a space to share whatever, because it's their session as well. It's like as a therapist, we often go in going, okay, I'm going to do this, this, and this. That's not our purpose. Our purpose is just sit there and be there and provide the space, hold the space. And so managing that imposter syndrome of am I a good enough therapist because we're not doing all the therapy things, mm-hmm. Has been a real challenge. But that's, I guess, where the benefit of supervision comes in. But also, yeah, embracing wabi-sabi, and that therapy isn't perfect. I'm not a perfect therapist. I'm not a perfect, you know, public speaker, and I go off on a whole bunch of different tangents. This is probably reflective of my therapy sessions, actually. But it is the beauty and the perfection, and I love it, and I'm embracing it as I go on, and I think that also helps me in my family life as well, because it's I'm not a perfect dad, and even though I'm a therapist, I still struggle, and I'm not a perfect partner at times, and when I walk in the door at night time, I'm not. Even though I've got all the theoretical concepts in my brain about how to manage mental health, I still come home and I'm just like, you know, aggro or grumpy or mm-hmm. or depressed, anxious, all these, they still happen to me. And just embracing that and going, you know what, I'm human as well. We mentioned, you know, the humanity of us as therapists is I'm human and I accept that and I'll just go with it as well.
No, you're absolutely right. Nobody is perfect. It doesn't exist. And the humanized aspect of it, you can go through different aspects of that, but understanding too, like you can have the theories in your head. Oh, well, this is how you handle this problem. But that's not reality. And even to speak to what you're saying about therapy, half the time I feel like I'm rambling in session. I'm like, I don't even know if I said anything important. But I think it's just having that space to know you get to go there at certain points and have that. And I appreciate you sharing just like the building blocks that you've gone through personally, professionally. And what are some of the tangible tools in the sense of softwares or programs or apps that you've used to build your business?
There's a program called Halixy. I'm not sure if it's international. I think it may be, but it's just a software program that I use for case notes and bookings, and it does all my invoicing and all that type of stuff. But outside of that, it's very simple. Like it's Zoom if I need to, if I'm doing telehealth with guys across Australia, I do it. It's driving around and just being with guys. You know, some of my tools and that I use is a basketball or a footy, or it's, you know, walking along the beach. Like it's mm-hmm. nature. Nature's in my tool in terms of therapy as well. So yeah, I don't overcomplicate it. And I think that's a good reason I don't overcomplicate it, is because then the perfectionism stuff would come in. Like, is everything, you know, perfect if I use a certain type of platform? But I just want to simplify it and make it accessible for everybody. So yeah, aside from Halixy, I don't use anything outside of what's naturally available to me.
I love that. And definitely, it sounds like a great software. We don't have it here. At least I've never heard of it. So always adding new things to my list. But can you share a success story or any moments of transformation that you've witnessed through your work with Mindful Men?
I think I'll probably merge a few clients together just for that privacy reason. But I think it comes down to that mindfulness on the move stuff. It's introducing guys to the concept of mindfulness and going, you know, it's not just the gratitude journaling, which they usually refer it to, but it's this moment of being present while we're walking around and grounding ourselves in nature. And there's a few clients that I've worked with where they really enjoyed. We went through like a bit of a rainforest walk with one guy, and we often laugh because we were talking about leaves on a stream, which is this concept in acceptance and commitment therapy, where a thought might come into our minds, and then instead of wallowing on it and letting it, you know, infest our brains and take us too many tangents, we just let it go. And the whole concept of a leaf, you know, floating by on a stream, it's just, it comes and goes and it is what it is. But we found this moment where this a leaf was going around in circles because there was a stream happening, happened to be where we were, and just where the rocks were, like the water was going around like a little tiny little whirlpool, and there's just some leaf stuck in there. And we refer to that as stop wallowing in shit. It just goes around and around, and we always now we have this image of that, and he laughed about it, and he always brings it up now, and you know, and that's how it is. That's what therapy looks like with me. It's talking real. I swear if I need to. I talk how the guys talk. I adapt, you know, to their level as well. And you know, other guys, you know, just walking in the beach. There's one guy that lived a kilometer from the beach. We have some of those beautiful beaches in the Sunshine Coast where I live, and he'd never been to the beach because for some reason he'd lived up here for about a year, and he always wanted to go on the beach, never been to the beach. So what did I do? We went down to the beach and we got in. Like, I took off my Mindful Men t-shirt. I didn't have bathers on, but we just got in, and lucky I had a towel in the car and so forth. And he loved it. And then he told me the next time I saw him, he's like, yeah, I came down to the beach again. And you know, it was awesome. And just giving guys, just doing it with the guys. And I call my therapy experiential therapy. So if they get a bubble tea, there's some guys that love bubble teas. I get a bubble tea as well. Like, I'm not a bubble tea drinker, but I'll give it a go. And you know, or slushies down, you know, at the 7-Eleven or you name it, I'll get it as well. And it's part of the therapy process. It's not about me distancing myself from the client. It's about me just being in there. And so by doing that, the guys, yeah, they're just really opening up. And I'm surprised at how many love the mindfulness stuff and using their five senses and you know, talking about leaves on streams and wallowing in shit. Like, they just love it. And it's so refreshing because most guys don't talk about that type of stuff. You know, when we get together, it's very superficial. It's like, oh, what's the footy? What's happening in sports? Or what's our partner doing? What's our kid doing? How grumpy are we at work? It's all very superficial. But then in these therapy spaces, we can actually go deeper into things like mindfulness and gratitude and grounding ourselves. And the topics go very deep and meaningful, and it's fantastic. But it all starts with just introducing mindfulness to start with. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I think it's such a big part of therapy, but also everyday life, because when we're more in the moment, we can experience more things, or we're able to release a lot of things too, instead of focusing on the next thing. Or especially, I have anxiety as well. Those things that come up, the more mindfulness I do in particular, the more I feel in the moment. And I do more like mindful eating, movement, those things too. I started with the gratitude. I mean, I still do it here and there, but how to bring it back in. But lastly, what message or words of encouragement would you like to share with men who may be struggling with their mental health? What do you want them to know about their own resilience and the potential for healing and growth?
Oh, I loved how you brought up the word resilience, because it's something that many people, not just guys, don't realize they have. And so I love this concept of, like, I saw this on Instagram or Facebook or somewhere. It's like, you've survived 100% of your worst days.
Yes.
No matter how dark yesterday was, or challenging those 30 years were, or whatever, you're still here, still rocking up, living life. It might not look like the life that you wanted it to look like, and you might be stuck in bed or anything, but you still wake up, you're still here on, you know, on earth. And so I love that concept, because it shows that resilience, we all have it. We all have resilience, and we're all strong. And I reflect on that with the guys that I work with. It's like, what did you do last time when you were in this kind of funk? You know, did you go to the gym or did you fix up your eating? Did you stop drinking so much? Did you stop taking so much drugs? Did you talk to someone? And we just pull into their toolkits and they go, oh, yeah, I did this last time and it really helped. Okay, well, let's do that again. You know, that's your resilient factor. That's your strength. And so that's a key one. But I think it's for a lot of guys, it's just recognizing that it's not weak to speak. It's a strength. It's okay to be not okay. I'm throwing out a few of these cliche, you know, one-liners in the mental health space, but that's what we do. Like it is. And you know, if I can do it for the last hour or so that we've been doing this, then you can do it as well. Like it's a normal thing and we should normalize it as much as possible. And the only way we can normalize it is by talking about it as yes. well. Like, you know, just open up and it feels better when you do. Like every time I do a podcast or a talk or something like that, or a training session, I even get a bit of a therapeutic, you know, feeling to it as well, because I've just, you know, shared some stuff that I've either forgotten about or it's given me a new, you know, frame of light to look at it. And it's a good thing to do. It's tiring. Like, don't get me wrong. It's tiring. It takes work. Like anything, like you said, going to the gym, you've got to show up and actually do the exercises to get that physical fitness. So it's the same with therapy. You've got to show up. You've got to do your homework. Mm-hmm. But once you do, you get to a place where you're well again and mm-hmm. you can kind of go off on your own ride and do it solo and then eventually come back for your tune-up. So, yeah, just start by talking. It's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, you got to release it, right? But Simon, where can people find you, find your services? I'm going to link everything below, but if you could let us know too.
Yeah, so for social work in terms of therapy, I only practice in Australia. So that's really important to know because my insurance doesn't go that far. But it's www.mindful-men.com.au. That's my website, the one that nearly killed me. But then that links to all my socials as well. So I'm on Instagram, just mindful.men.aos on pretty much most of the platforms. You can come and just see some of the stuff that I do. I post about, I do share a lot about the Mindful Men podcast. So I've got the podcast as well where I share stories across the world. And I feel it's really important to just do that to show guys that it's okay to talk. So the website and then, yeah, just Google or yeah, find me at mindful.men.aos on whatever platform you're on.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Simon, for just being so transparent and vulnerable about your experience. And I know it's going to help so many other men that you're already helping, but more that will be coming in to realize that it's okay to talk about your emotions, not suppressing them, but just being more mindful of it and present with what you're dealing with so you can release that and you don't have to carry that all by yourself anymore. But thank you again for coming on and just sharing your amazing energy with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Make sure to like, subscribe, comment below. What was your biggest takeaway from Simon today? I'm sure he would love to see that comment, and we'll see you on the next episode.